Thank you for listening to KBOO Community Radio. My name is Sam Bowman. Greetings. Welcome to the Bread and Butter Podcast. We have a seat for you right over here. If you could just... Yes, excellent. I'll bring you some water in a minute, then some crayons for the kids. There you are. And you. Great. Now, thank you for listening to the first episode of Bread and Butter, a podcast devoted to the voices of people who have stood up to their boss, company, landlord, the centers of power in our everyday lives, and taken the consequences. There are often no manuals for this sort of action, and it is easy to be cynical about the prospects of organizing your coworkers, filing a wage claim, or contesting an eviction notice. This show aims to bring together stories from people who have done these things. Many of them were not successful, but their stories can help demystify what your rights are and how to protect them in the fundamentally unbalanced relationships that define the bread and butter of American life. Because together we can... that was the linguine parmesan, and yes, chicken strips for the kids. Okay, I'll be back in a little bit with your food. Y'all folks, enjoy the show. The sunrise, and set for you. But the same sunrise and set and shine on the purple too. I don't mind you turning around. I myself would even like a little higher ground. But it's high time that you find. The same people you walk on your way up, you might meet them as you did on your way down.
I think it was in, let's see, when did I start there? I think it was 2011 or 2010. I started working at Pete's, and there were some other people working there that had been working there for a couple years beforehand that were part of the group.
That's Claire Valentine Fossum. She's a native of St. John's who moved to Illinois for college in 2005 and stayed in Chicago after graduation, working at one of Chicago's Pete's Coffee and Tea shops. Pete's Coffee and Tea is a company that's familiar to Portlanders, but back in 2010, they were still moving into the Chicago market. Pete's began as a coffee-focused Bay Area chain that built its customer base on warm customer service and close attention to quality in coffee roasting. At one point, CEO Pat O'Day said that what makes his company great is that they, quote, challenge the status quo through the lens of our values. However, in the years preceding Claire's employment at Pete's, the company experienced major growth and reorganization, which was experienced by shop staff as new rules about speed, less focus on coffee quality and customer service, and a new disconnect with the corporate end of the company. These issues were soon a regular topic of frustration and discussion among Claire and her coworkers.
Basically, we kind of started talking about how there were a lot of issues with safety in the cafe, and a lot of concern with especially like wrist safety and ergonomics when you're working on the machines. And so we kind of started talking a little bit about that. And a few of us had backgrounds in organizing previously. And so we kind of just started talking like, well, is this something we can solve through organization? And is this something we can solve through a union? And so I was a shift lead, which is sort of like a supervisory position. And you're trained onto the proper procedure to pull an espresso shot, the proper procedure for using the coffee machines. And these are procedures that are put in place for safety. But in the real world, when you're trying to implement these things, it's not really possible with the speed that they're also requiring you to put the drinks out at. And so a lot of what we were trying to do was to bring those rules back and actually take action and do those things. So we're using both hands to pull an espresso shot instead of doing the quick way, which is one, but causes wrist damage. And so a lot of what we were gathering behind was, let's start using these safety procedures in the workplace, and we're gonna, and bringing people in and saying, you know, use both hands. And there's a thing called a bump screen where the drink goes up on the screen, the drink order. And when you're done with it, you push the button that says you're done. But the problem is that you get so many drinks in at once that you're just, it's just flying, and you're just flying trying to make the drinks. And so people will push the done button and then bring them back, because if it's, the drink goes over 30 seconds or something, some ridiculous number like that, it changes color and you get a red flag and then you get marked. You know, you have to go talk with the manager if you have too many of those. And it just makes you look really bad. There's a printout at the end of the day that says who's the slow person. And so there's a big, you know, push if you want the hours to go really fast and to risk your body and your wrists. And so that was their biggest thing, because everyone was experiencing that. At one point, we used to have three people on the floor. Then they cut, I remember the day they cut us back to two people. Legally, you have to have one person or two people there. You can't have one person there. So that basically was the bare minimum to get everything done, to make the drinks, to take the orders, to get people their coffee beans, to clean the store, to make sure the bathrooms are clean, to restock everything on the floors, to just greet customers when they come in, to sell merchandise. And you can imagine during coffee rush, before and after work, or when the schools get out, or there's a big event, that's just not feasible. So that was a big rallying point, was this is not safe. What the practices that were going on. And then after that, it was things like hours, you know, equality in the workplace. But the biggest thing, I think, was safety, and that was the biggest rallying point. Also, this idea of having the employee work off the clock for free because of compassion for their other employees, which is a big thing we're seeing now. Totally illegal to work off the clock, right? Yet people are working on their break. Why? Because we're short-staffed, and that's your friend out there getting hammered and you feel compelled to help them, or because you're a supervisor and you don't have enough time to do your paperwork on the clock because you have to work the floor because it's you and one other employee. So you're doing your paperwork then on your break. And I think there's a lot of reliance on that model as well. And this understanding that, well, this person this person cares about their coworkers. They work with them every day, and they can't really take a break. They have to go help on the floor. And that was actually a really big challenge with some of our people that we were working with, was getting them to say, no, I'm on break. And yeah, things are going to crumble, but no, I'm on break. And this is my legal break. And I need to sit down and I need to rest and I need to eat some food and I need to use the bathroom. That was a big deal. Like, just getting people to stop and say, I need to use the bathroom. And that was a really big challenge, I think, that we worked with, because that's so ingrained in everybody, is I don't need a break. I don't need a break from the register. I don't need a break for lunch. I don't need a break from the coffee bar. My wrists are fine, even though they're bandaged up. Your wrists aren't fine. And that was a really difficult challenge that we also had to face, was trying to get people to say no.
The fledgling Pete's Workers Group realized it would need to be careful about who they talked to. Organizing workers at small shops that are part of a larger non-union company is a subtle craft that must take in the differences between shops, workers, and managers.
Actually, I just saw a quote by Cesar Chavez today about how, you know, you talk to one person and then you talk to another person and then you talk to another person. And it was a lot of that. So I guess it was a lot of talking to people, but it was a lot of trying to figure out how to speak to people. And that was the really hard part, was you can't be too aggressive when you're speaking to someone. You have to figure out kind of where they're coming from and also what's going to click for them, and sort of make it like on their level, something that they want to do, not something that you're sort of forcing onto them. And so we just started, you know, a couple of us started talking to some other people, and then they got involved. And then as that grew, we branched out from there, with people coming in with different ideas and different strengths. And then we started having meetings and just started getting the ball rolling that way.
And, like, to what degree was that secret from the management?
So we wanted to keep it a secret in a way, not just from the management, but in general from the higher corporation. Because there had been previous times when other cafes had been trying to organize and they was just immediately shut down. So we wanted to make sure that we had a really strong base before we kind of came out as an organization. We didn't want it to get destroyed in the very beginning before we could actually, you know, establish ourselves. So it was secret, I guess, almost 5 months, I guess, before that, which was really hard because you're talking to people and you want to get more people involved and you want them to understand that the management isn't at fault here. They are dealing with the same issues basically that we are. They're having to cut labor. They're getting direction from the top that they probably don't want to deal with. And they know people need money and hours. And so we were trying to show them that this isn't against the management, but at the same time, we can't really speak to the management about this yet because they will have to immediately report that there's an organization starting. And that's also a big word with the U word. The union word was really big in trying to come up with other words that we, instead of using the union word, because that's an automatic red flag, especially if management hears that. So we kind of came up with like a list of demands and a good solid like group of people that were on board with those demands before we even published what we are doing. And we published that by giving them a letter basically of our demands.
At the time, there were only 2 Pete's shops in Chicago.
So it was one in Chicago and one in Evanston, which is a suburb directly outside of Chicago. So at the store that was located directly in the city, the management was really new. They knew the management, but they didn't necessarily have a lot of trust in the management from the very beginning because they didn't know them. So to build that group up was a bit easier because there wasn't an allegiance or this breaking of your allegiance to the management. Whereas as a store I worked at, the manager had come up as a barista and everyone, you know, and people were friends with her and they invited her to their, you know, to their wedding. And she came to barista espresso pouring championships. And so some people had issues when they were working at that store with, I don't want to hurt the manager here because, you know, we like her and she was a great person, you know, that she's a good, honest, hardworking person that really does understand that people need hours. There was some issues with people trying to bring people in from that store because there's that question of, well, I don't want to hurt my friend and I don't want to hurt my friend more than I want to join this organization. And so that was really hard, especially when you would talk to somebody there and you would reveal that to them what you're doing. And it would seem like this was a good idea, that they're on board, and then maybe a week later, suddenly, everything's out. And that happened. And that was kind of the big turning point of, oh, now we're outed, because we had told people, and this was a risk, this is a risk you have to take, is when you're trying, you know, you have to start talking to people. That's how you build an organization. But there's a risk that someone might leak your plan before you're ready to.
On September 3rd, 2012, the Pete's Workers Group went public and delivered their letter to management and then braced for the consequences.
Yeah, so I was there when they first had the letter, and it was this weird, it kind of was weird. It was, someone wrote this letter and it's going to be presented. And because we were showing people their letter that this is the letter we're going to be presenting, the rough draft of it. And this is kind of where we're coming from. These are the talking points that we have: safety first, and then, you know, stable hours, stable work environment, things like that. And so suddenly, oh, there's this letter being written. And who's writing it? That was the big question. Is Claire writing it? No, Claire's not the one writing it. So who's the one writing it? You know, and it was this big deal to find out who's the one writing it, which was funny, though, because it's not a who. It's the organization. It was the product of lots of people. So that was kind of funny when they're like trying to figure it out. And well, you can't figure it out because it's everybody, but it's nobody because it's ours. And what are you going to do? Fire everybody because you found out that maybe there's a letter? And so that was there. And then I know with the other stores, I guess later on what happened is after that came out, they presented the letter and then there were some issues where people were basically fired for being organizers. It didn't say that outright, but so Pete's has this rule, they did at least then, where if you're late by more than 5 minutes 3 times in a year, you get fired. And that rule is only used to get rid of people that they don't want. It's not used for people that, like, it's not across the board, everyone is subject to that rule. It's only really used for people they don't want. And they'll scramble your hours around, your schedule around a lot so that you maybe are late. And then they'll fire you. And so that was used with one of the organizers and who she had to, you know, be there at 4:30 in the morning and was late more than 5 minutes. And the management didn't mind, But the corporate headquarters called in when they had seen her three strikes and said, fire her, because they knew she was one of the major organizers of the group. And then from there, actually, there was a lot of support from the customers that knew her because she had been there for so long, and rallying behind her and trying to, you know, signing petitions to get her job back. There were protests outside the store. The customers were supporting it, which was really cool because they were like, no, this person's a hard worker and she deserves her job and she deserves to work in a safe environment. And, you know, I agree with what they're proposing here. So that was a really good feeling, even though that people were getting, you know, fired or threatened.
Yeah. And in general, how was the customer response to this sort of thing?
So at that store, I think there was a little bit more solidarity from the customers because...
And I'm sorry, that's the store in Chicago.
Yeah. Okay. So in the central store, there were more people on board in general with the organization. And there were more, I think, customer support because you had a lot of people that were regulars. Well, there were regulars at both stores. The other store, there was a lot of turnover, I guess, in the staff. A lot of the staff are students. And so there was some customer support, but... not as much, I think, as we were hoping for, especially from like the college that was nearby. We were trying to organize with the college in some respects, but it was really difficult to get students involved and to get students that were working there involved because it was, okay, yeah, I care about this issue, but I have homework and I'm going to be gone in 4 years and this is a temporary job, a part-time job. It's not my livelihood. Like, it might be for someone at another store. Plus, they all knew that the manager there. And so they were like, I don't want to, you know, I love the manager. I don't want to do anything against the manager.
Yeah. And do you remember any of the forces against it at all? Like the actions that were taken, if any?
Well, the biggest thing I know that someone was fired and there were threats to people that were petitioning to get the person their job back. Threats. There was one coworker that was sitting outside on her break when the petition was being signed outside the store. And she, her like corporate affiliates came down and basically came to that store. And they're saying, you know, you're going to get fired. And she's like, I'm just sitting out here on my break eating, you know, like a sandwich or something. And, oh, well, you got to go back in the store. You're going to get fired. And so there was a lot of that, a lot of threats. Just, I mean, anything to stop it, basically, as well as cutting people's hours once they found out that someone was organizing.
In addition to hostility from corporate, the organizers became very familiar with the problems of trying to organize workers in the service industry, with its high rates of turnover, low job security, and pervasive cynicism stemming from the general view of the American service industry as something you get out of rather than try to improve.
It's really limited. I mean, it's really limited when you're trying to organize, even in the nation or just at your store, when you're working with people that they're only working there part-time. They're just barely making it. They've also got maybe another job. They've also got other commitments, family, school, you know, the rest of their community. There's other separations between you, maybe like age differences or language barriers. And so I think that was a really difficult challenge that we were facing that maybe like other unions in the past haven't faced, which is exciting in some ways because it's new. And these are new challenges that we'll have to deal with if we want to organize, like, basically service workers is looking at these challenges. And it was good to get that out of the way and talk to the Starbucks union or talk to IWW and figure out how do you like overcome these challenges.
Quick sidebar here, folks. Yes, the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies, are still a thing. Portland has one of the country's more active branches, the IWW we all learned about from our high school textbooks with its bombs and vast marches is a thing of the past. But the current incarnation is having an impact on modern organizing concepts. I spoke last year with Ryan Gowan, an organizer with the Portland chapter at their local offices, a converted house on East Burnside Street. He explained the difference between traditional unionism and the style of organizing that characterizes the Pete's Workers Group.
So public, by that term, we mean that there's like the union has been certified as the bargaining agent for workers there. So it's an actual like legal relationship. Okay. Where people who work there have the protection of union membership status. And in those shops in particular, they have contracts or collective bargaining agreements in place. So that's what we mean by public, is that the workers there can very publicly state that they're union members. But the vast majority of the organizing that we do is actually under the radar. So we do a lot of organizing with workers, particularly in the service industry, where the union is like not common knowledge. Our strategy is to get workers together to try to strategize about making things better at work and making change happen at work, and having them act in concert with each other to make that change happen. Now, the employer may or may not know that there's union activity involved, but they know it when they see it. They know when they see workers approaching them with a demand that that's some kind of organized activity. So a lot of what we do is educating workers on how to organize and take those steps themselves. And that's our particular brand, if you will, of unionism. It's called Solidarity Unionism.
One of the most prominent organizing efforts the local IWW has been involved in is the Burgerville Workers Group, which went public earlier this year and has tenaciously pushed their case with the Vancouver-based company since then. The IWW has also worked with workers groups at Starbucks and Jimmy John's, as well as a handful of social service agencies. The differences between the two types of organizing Gowan described also came to the fore during the struggle to start the Pete's Workers Group in Chicago.
So internal challenges definitely come up when you have multiple locations that are trying to organize under one roof, as opposed to, say, just like you just have a factory and everyone's there at the factory and everyone knows everybody. And that might be easier than, okay, now there's six factories, or there's two factories, or there's two coffee shops like we had. And someone that can be difficult for trust issues. Maybe someone at coffee shop A doesn't really know the organizer over here at coffee shop B. So they might agree to it, but they don't really know this person. So we would try and organize events outside of work. But once again, you're running into other commitments that people have. But just so that was a challenge of trying to get everyone on the same page when they didn't work together. We would also have people come from one store to another store to try and sub in and talk with people there. It was really strong at the store in Chicago, the organization was. It wasn't as strong at the store where I was at in Evanston. And so we would have people from the Chicago store come and try and work at the Evanston store and just kind of, this is who I am. Now you know who I am. Also, here's this thing we're doing. We're organizing and I'm part of the group. Other internal struggles we had were making the demand letter, and communication was a really big challenge when you're just communicating by email or phone, as opposed to seeing someone every day in the workplace. It can become kind of difficult to try and organize and get everyone together on the same page, on the same like list of, I think there were like so many drafts of the list of demands. And some people, let's just do it. Like, it doesn't matter what kind of paper it's printed on. Let's just get it out there. And other people will know it does. Everything should look super professional. So we want it to be on this really nice paper, like a real letter that we're going to send off to the company that we're going to have people sign. So there were, you know, challenges of when do we come out and when do we present ourselves and how do we talk to people and is this person safe to talk to, basically. So there was a lot of that internal challenges of going on. I think those are the biggest things that I kind of wish that we had been better at communicating, I think.
And so that, just from my own personal experience in service work, I definitely noticed there's a certain brand of cynicism that people have about those kind of jobs, and just kind of, you know, this is terrible, or, you know, this isn't the greatest thing in the world, but I'll deal with it and I'll move on.
Mm-hmm.
Did you run up against that with a lot of people?
Oh, definitely. That was a big issue. I mean, it's not a career per se, right? That's not... Service jobs aren't really considered careers, except for when they are. And, you know, you've been working there for 8 years and you've been dealing with the same stuff going on. You've been dealing with the same, you have the same pay, you know, pay increases aren't going up. And so, but I mean, I think, and it's not just people working there, it's everybody. No one really views it. It's the customers. It's the people that are working there. It's since general society as a whole is you're a service worker. This is just, you know, this is just a job for high schoolers or students for part-time. You know, it's not really considered real, but it is real. And I think there is that cynicism that sets in with everybody then. And it's really easy to get burnt out when you're daily challenge is trying to overcome that. And as well as everything else that you're doing. And then also, I think that the other challenge in there, aside from that, probably adds to the cynicism, is the speed that you have to get everything done at, and then you're exhausted. And how do you organize after that?
Or you work really hard to get more hours and then spend those more hours doing the same thing.
Right. Or, you know, you work a 40-hour job and another, you know, job, you know, or you're maybe, or actually you don't work 40 hours because no one gets 40 hours anymore, but you work a part-time job and another part-time job and another part-time job, and you still don't have, you know, benefits, but you have to make money. And how do you organize then if you've got no time because you're working or like sleeping pretty much or taking care of your kids?
As you can probably tell, it's not hard to let discussions between service workers devolve into kvetching and shop talk, but the frustration is real and stems from something organizers call the disposable employee model, used, consciously or not, by many service industry employers. This is the idea that even though high turnover has its costs and the frequent training of new employees, it is worth it because the company has to give few to no benefits to part-time workers who will in turn become frustrated and leave, and be replaced by a fresh crop of desperate workers willing to work part-time for low pay and no benefits. This was a concept the Peets workers were not at first aware of, but it soon became a central part of their case against the company.
I don't think that was something that was something, I guess, in the back of our minds, but I won't say it was like a defined concept in the very beginning. Once again, the beginning was just about safety, pretty much. But then we also were talking about the disposable employee, that three strikes and you're out rule, or the, you know, this week you get 10 hours, next week you get 15 hours, next week you get 7 hours, and then 3 hours. Well, why would anyone stick around? Well, it doesn't matter because they can leave and you can get somebody else in, and then you'll have to spend a bunch more money training them and time training them. But they're coming in and they're working part-time and they're not getting benefits and they're, you know, working for a low wage. So that doesn't, the time spent, I guess, training them isn't really seen as a big issue on the outside. On the floor, it definitely is, because then, you know, you've got someone that's inexperienced and you're trying to help them. But yeah, I think that there's not really a commitment to the employees, to as seeing them as people. It's really easy to just see them as people that are trying to sell coffee beans.
The Peets Workers Group has been defunct since 2013, the same year Claire returned to Portland, but it has had an impact. The group and the worker Emma Bell Byrne, who was fired during the campaign, were profiled by the Atlantic Monthly last year in an article about millennials and unions. Their blog, peetsworkersgroup.blogspot.com, is still up and has screenshots of the customer petitions, flyers, and the back-and-forth letters between the workers and the company. Most importantly, the group added their name to the growing list of service industry shops, most recently and locally Burgerville, that are organizing on the solidarity model, learning from each other's successes and mistakes, and gaining more ground and public acceptance every time. Thank you for listening to episode 1 of the Bread and Butter Podcast. It was written and produced by myself, Sam Bowman, for KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, with thanks to Alan Toussaint for our theme music. Thank you for listening. Stay strong. Here you go. Here's the check. And where'd you go? Where? Oh, what the hell? Come on.